And that's right, don't laugh at me. This here is Big Dot, better known as Missionary Kenneth Wolfgang, with you on another Jumbo Braille program here on the 6Eyes Radio Network. The one and only program here on the 6Eyes Radio Network that can be felt. Saying welcome one, welcome all to our program tonight, especially our surrounding city and states and our countries near and far, as well as those who've called 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. Press the number one, join the conversation as we get ready to go into part two tonight of our in-depth study and thing on the Ashtabula Horror, better known as the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster. But before we do that, Ruth, who do we got with us tonight?
Well, as always, we have the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. We have you, Sister Emily, her dad, Six, and me.
All right, how we doing tonight, Six?
Dot Six is great. How's it going? I am great. You guys can't hear me?
Real good. Sound good to me.
Oh, Jesus, I'm talking to y'all. My God.
Yep, you're sounding good to me, Six.
Sound really good to me.
So why take it so long to answer?
Well, I answered yes, that you're sounding good.
Sound great here.
Carry on.
Well, you sounded good to me. I just don't understand why you're not saying anything. You're saying you're perfectly good. Could be, I don't know. It's just we hear you perfectly clear, and I hear you saying you're doing fine. And Emily, how you doing tonight? Well,
real
she probably
peachy.
Didn't get her coffee yet. Huh?
No, I said I'm real peachy.
Oh, you are? Well, at least don't let no one eat you.
Hey, when she gets to the next place, I'm going to have to definitely plant a peach tree.
If she's peachy,
yeah.
We hope. Em, if you're peachy, we hope no one puts you in a pie.
All right, Kenny, babe.
Well,
you better behave with the founder of the station on the air tonight.
Oh, Kenny.
Yeah.
You didn't tell him what happened, did you?
No.
I talked to John McTernan today. And he actually had me get this guy named Patty pray for me. And ever since I got prayed for, I'm feeling better in a lot of ways. So I'll just tell you guys, I got to praise God for some prayers for people, and the Lord's doing something.
All right. But also,
well, God is good. Well, before we get started, I wanted to make a couple of announcements. All right, this is January 6, 2022, and we here at the Six Eyes Radio want to take a moment of silence for the 2021 insurrection. So we're going to take a moment of silence. So we want to remember those on that day, and my thoughts and prayers goes out to the families because there were some lives lost. So we're just praying for a great outcome tomorrow. Well, today, did nothing go wrong. So that's a blessing right there. And we're also under a thunderstorm advisory till the 7th. So please make sure you check on the elderly. If you have pets that are able to go inside and you have room, please make them comfortable inside your home. If not, and they're an outdoor pet, please make sure they have a warm blanket, preferably a doggy bed, plenty of water, plenty of food, and a nice doghouse. So, now back to the Jumbo Braille program. Thank you.
Kenny, we just got Tim Groover on the air right now. Just letting you know he's here.
Amen, amen. Hello, Brother Tim.
Who?
How you doing,
yeah,
sir?
I want to say welcome to you, Tim. And just to let you guys know where we've been so far with our program, last week we covered on this show part one about the Ashtabula Horror, better known as the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster, that took the life of gospel songwriter P.P. Bliss, as well as many others that were on the railroad passenger train in Ashtabula, Ohio. We covered the fact that when the train fell into the Ashtabula Gorge, we covered the fact that it did fall, and we covered the fact that what happened was it was the bridge that collapsed, and we also covered the fact that after it fell, the train not only wrecked, but at the same time, they allowed the train to continue to burn after it caught on fire, and that the officials in charge, they did not give the orders to put out the fire. So we covered that, and then we started to cover about the relics and the identifying of the people who were on the train. That's where we kind of left off last week. And this week we're going to get a little more into the survivors and the people that were on the train and the stuff like that. So we're getting more into that this week, the love, the lost, and different parts about that. So we'll be getting more into the people that were on board, that kind of thing. So we'll be discussing all that. And Tim, if you got any quick comments before we get started, we'll let you say what you wanted to say.
Actually, I do have a special prayer request. If you would please pray for my cousin, Lisa Lair. She happens to have a blood clot between her skull and her brain, and she's going to be getting operated on tomorrow. So if you pray for my cousin, Lisa Lair, and also, of course, for her spiritually and also for the salvation of her mother, my aunt, Linda.
All right. All right, everybody. So with that, I think what we'll do, we'll get started tonight. And this is part two, once again, of the Ashtabula Horror, the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster. And we have one more coming next week. So we'll finalize next week on this. But tonight, here we go as we get into this episode. Amen. The following is a true story of the Ashtabula Bridge disaster, which occurred in December 29, 1876. However, there are details of this accident which may be too sensitive for some listeners, so listener discretion is advised. It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the following is a true story of the Ashtabula Bridge disaster, which occurred in December 29, 1876. However, there are details of this accident which may be too sensitive for some listeners, so listener discretion is advised. It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn, question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time. Find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30, 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 13th, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
It was well that the revolting sights of that dark, that horrid morgue were denied to many of the friends. Every effort was taken to relieve the pangs of sorrow and to remove the revolting features of that awful scene. Coffins were soon procured. Each body was placed in its silent, its narrow house. The keeper of the morgue was stationed to watch the sacred forms. He was a silent man. Tall and dark and gloomy, he walked amid the dead, but beneath that silent face, he wore a kindly and sympathetic heart. He seemed himself to be struck with the grief which went so deep into so many loving souls. His tones were tender. His ways were kind. He walked amid the dead until it seemed as if his habitation must be the grave. It was only to express a sympathy for the bereft. His was a gloomy and melancholy task, and yet it was a sacred trust, as those bodies which he guarded so well were very sacred to many hearts. There were other officials who were appointed for the trying emergency who seemed peculiarly adapted for their work. A gentleman was stationed in the office of the same building whose duty it was to guard the relics which should be found. His position was indeed a difficult one. He was an employee of the road and yet had been appointed by the coroner to fill this place. The very equivocal attitude in which this double duty put him rendered it a most inevitable office. The list of articles was left with him, and at the same time the articles themselves as they were found. If there was obedience to the claims of humanity and regard to his personal feelings, there might be a loss to the company. There was a regard to the financial interests of the company and a desire to shield it from loss. There was the fearful temptation to sacrifice his honor and break his trust. Sympathy and courtesy of the man was certainly manifest to all. Even the articles which had been recovered by the mayor's proclamation were consigned to him, and everything belonged to the loss of the fatal train. Very proof that persons were on it depended on the trifling things which were under his care. A key, a watch, or chain, or cap, or dress might be in evidence in law. Thus, the affection of friends who sought for these with such avidity and unwearied diligence appealed to his humane and kindly heart, and yet a loss to the company might ensue from every discovery made. The freedom, too, which these relics were reached by the constantly changing crowds rendered a loss by dishonest hands a probable result, yet it was impossible to refuse access to them without being misunderstood. And so the physician was surrounded with embarrassments, and yet the testimony was universal to its courtesy and kindness through it all, and the many relics which were found by friends showed how faithfully he performed his task. On the ground where the train had fallen was another official of the road. His work was to superintend those who were gathering relics. This position was a tedious, difficult, and in many respects a thankless one. With hands, feet, rakes, and hoes, and in various ways the precious relics were fish from out the stream. Everything was preserved, bits of rags and pieces of jewelry, shreds of clothing and gold watches, a worthless strap or a diamond pin. Anything and everything which gave trace of the passengers was gathered and placed in the hands of Mr. Steger and then deposited in the morgue. With all the suspicion and all the rumors, the public became at last satisfied that the authorities were doing all they could to gather relics for the friends and that the traces of the dead were not intentionally destroyed. They were all railroad men who were engaged in this work. These tasks were performed by human men under the shadow of the public doubt and public grief, amid which there was excitement and the haste of business and the burden of care. That there were human hearts underneath all this machinery of life, the employees of the road were, many of them, melted to tears. Everyone was subdued by the sudden death. Even the hardness produced by their public life was softened by the common sorrow. The tide of human sympathy burst through even the most rocky hearts and overflowed all of their feelings. In the crowded office in the station house, the telegraph was constantly at work. Its click and buzz was heard as it talked with lightning tongues and reported the widespread grief and responded with short and comprehensive words. It seemed as if the nation had been touched. Those words of wire penetrated the remotest fibers of the whole nation's heart, and they seemed to be singing with intensest pain. The arrow which had shot the pang into so many hearts had left the bowstring whizzing in the hand. The griefs of many, many homes were expressed by those very sounds. Hour after hour, the messages would come and go, and every word was fraught with intense feeling. The division superintendent sat at the table amid the representatives of the press and friends who crowded to the desk without, and it seemed as if the silent man had his hand upon the heartstrings of the land. How anyone could endure the strain of such a place and not falter in his task was a mystery to many. Only those who are accustomed to the position when so many human lives are under their constant care could bear this crushing weight. The nobleman who came down upon the train and went out upon the bridge, of which an engineer he had the charge is said to have wept like a worn child as he saw the sight. That stern, careworn face expressed more than many knew. As the questions were plied so thick and fast by the representatives of the press and were sent home by those who knew something of the facts, the same courteous reply went back. No one apprehended the responsibility of his place more than he. No one felt perhaps the doubts and suspicions and public feeling more. No one realized more the nature of the calamity and all its bearings, and yet that same calm and courteous manner remained. Oh, he was calm without, but God only knew what he felt within. Those who knew him best had told something of the tender sensibilities of the man. On New Year's morning, he was with his wife in her father's home on the east side of Ashtabula River, where they often were. But on that morning, as he stepped outdoors before breakfast, the coachman met him and wished him a happy New Year. He returned the greeting, but as he sat down to breakfast, his feelings were deeply moved. The tears came into his eyes, his face became suffused, and he seemed overwhelmed. At last, the brave man gave way and buried his head in his hands and sobbed, and then he controlled himself and said, "John bid me a happy New Year this morning, but how can it be a happy New Year to me?" There was a succession of arrivals of people. Each day brought a different class. First the officials of the road, next the crowds of curious men and women from the village and surrounding country, then the representatives of the press from the distant cities, Chicago and New York, then the long swelling wave of the surrounding friends. From farther and farther away, this wave swept in. At last the two sides of the continent were reached. Two oceans had sent their echoes to moan over the graves of those who had left their shores. The coast of Maine and the Golden Gate had felt the shock. First were those from the nearer cities. These had either bidden goodbye a few hours before or were waiting depot for the arrival of their friend. New Year's Day was nigh. A gentleman with Cleveland on his way to California. His wife was on her way to meet him, two children with her on the train. They expected to spend New Year's together in that city. She telegraphed that she was coming. He was at the depot awaiting her arrival. The train was late, but he waited there. At last, the tidings came. He took the train with the officials and arrived in the night. Two children were dead, and the wife was awfully burned. She was now lingering between life and death. The new year would find her dead and the man bereft of wife and children. Mother had been waiting for a wife and child. He came and found them dead. The dread reality was worse than the worst of fears. But the morning came. The friends at Cleveland hastened to the cars at an early hour, thinking to take them and reach the spot by 9 o'clock. But at the hour assigned, the train delayed. Those who were warned of the wreck by the morning papers also went to the depot, but they could not go. Women whose husbands were on the fatal train were there and became anxious to start, but the train delayed. Fathers whose sons were wounded became uneasy at the delay. Businessmen who knew that their partners were coming among the lost wondered that their partners were among the lost, wondered at the long delay. Mothers whose little children were among the dead also were sick at heart, but the train delayed. The suspense became too much to bear, the train delayed. The agony increased. Some fainted in their seats and were taken to the air. Feeling became intense that busy depot would become a house of weeping. Sorrow was depicted on every face. Sympathy moved the hearts of strangers. Those gloomy walls became a prison to the heart. Those heavy columns and lofty arches seemed draped with mourning. The iron roof seemed filled with bars. It was a castle of despair. Even the stir and confusion of the place mocked the grief. Never was that place so full of sorrow that train delayed. Some returned to their homes and again came down. The city was moved. The fact became known upon the streets. Excitement even entered the business circles. Yet the train delayed. A young man lay in the Culver House. His face was deathly pale. His breathing labored. He was slowly dying. Father was on that train, delayed, and became very anxious. He was wealthy and offered money. Yes, the expense of the train he was willing to pay, with the train delayed. Alas, when patience was almost exhausted and the feeling was so intense and the night began to darken, the train moved out. Suspense was relieved, but the time was still too long and the distance great. They arrived at last. The son is dead. He breathes his last among the wounded. Strangers were there to lay him out, but the friends could only bury him. The arrival brought the whole reality to view. No one could tell the horror. It must be seen to be known. Search for friends must be carried on in the night. That horrid morgue was dark and covered with gloom. The scene of the wreck was also covered with the evening shades. Most of the bodies had by this time been removed. Those which remained were deeply buried beneath the ruins. The valley was lonely and sad. The death itself, which had come down with one fell swoop, had descended, leaving only the ashes of the burned, the dust of death, which had been gathered by hands of iron, eaten by the tongues of fire, and the night winds were making them their sport. Oh, how the heart went down into that lonely valley where so many perished. This night was full of tears. It was the second night. From one end of the land to the other, the fact was known. The greatest railroad accident on record had occurred. And that fall, so many went down. From the distant east to the distant west, the lightning had flashed their names. It's a stroke that spanned the heavens and revealed how black they were. This sorrow was continued. Day after day brought new scenes. Each train brought in new groups of friends. All were moved by a common feeling that their sorrow was visible. In that dreadful morgue, there were scenes which can never be described. God only knows what agony was in the hearts of many. The sorrowing company trooped in and out and varied every hour, men and women, fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, and even the children of the lost. Some already were dressed in mourning. Others had come in haste and stopped for nothing. Friends of the deceased from different places would meet at the spot, drawn together from a distance by the common bereavement. Different circles had been dressed for each one of those who had so suddenly died. Often two or three would come looking for the same person. a different state of feeling concentrated at each separate spot. The morgue, the office, and the wreck had all their clothes and their scenes. Citizens and friends, as they came, visited each in succession. Search for relics on the ice, the search for bodies in the morgue, and the sending of messages in the busy office brought different feelings to these sensitive hearts. There was a language in each place which spoke more than words. In the hotels at the upper town, there were also many exciting scenes. As the friends gathered from near and far, they passed from place to place, watching for some trace of the lost. Some became so overwhelmed by the great calamity, they were obliged to go home and send others who were less afflicted to continue the search. Fathers were almost crushed by the fearful blow and went in and out of the gloomy morgue and upon the cheerless ice and into the busy depot, sick at heart and depressed, and returned to their hotels, weary with the search and lonely amid the throngs for the sons or daughters, which they dove and nothing had gone forever. A young man came alone and sought his mother for four long and weary days, but couldn't find no trace. Each night he returned to the hotel with every lineament of his face expressive of the grief which was in his heart, and would sit down among the throngs of strangers, desolate and bereaved. Mother and friends came, seeking but finding not, and with tearful eyes would return at night, their sorrow growing deeper as their search was vain. Whoever expressed a sympathizing word to those bereaved and stricken ones knew how deeply the arrow had reached and how the soul was riven. But there were none who knew it all. To Isaiah, and that alone, was the grief revealed, and in his bottle were the tears preserved. There were times when it seemed as if the grief was too much to look upon. A woman was seen to pass through the morgue. Her hard, careworn face and humble dress showed her to be acquainted with poverty and accustomed to toil. But her husband was gone, and as the horrid scenes came before her gaze and the awful death was known, she fairly staggered in her steps. Her glaring eye and strange, wild look betokened a mind almost deranged. Yet the pity did not end, for another would come, so broken and so weak and so subdued in the widow's garb, and then the trembling father, and even the mother, stricken and bowed and almost heartbroken, so it seemed as if there were no end to grief. The week began with a search for relics. It was a difficult task. The wind was cold. The water was deep and frozen over. Snow and ashes filled the air. A confused heap of iron, tin roofs, broken trucks, and other debris were mingled into one mass of ruins. Company was organized for the work with the train dispatcher at the head. Men were hired, police were stationed, the ice was broken, great iron beams and rails and rods were drawn out. Trucks and wheels and brakes and bolts were moved away. And every spot was searched for traces of the dead. Watches, jewels, shreds of clothing, hands of women and arms of men were found. It was a place where diamonds lay, a stream where nuggets of gold were washed, a mine where they dug for treasures, all that men seek in distant lands. But there were human lives, which could not be found. Everything was closely scanned. Curiosity was fed by the constant search, and yet to friends the results were meager. A single bone was found, around which a chain was wound. It was the remains of a lady's arm. A watch was found. The gold was melted. The works were lost, but it bore the number and the pattern which proved it to belong to Reverend Dr. Washburn, the rector of Grace Church, Cleveland. Gentlemen made diligent search for some remains or relics of Dr. Hubbard of Des Moines. Iowa at last found a shawl, strap, and check which bore his name. The doctor's brother arrived from Boston, bringing his aged mother's description of his clothing, woolen socks, which she had knit for him, and two pairs of drawers, one worn inside of his socks. By this description, a limb which had been saved from burning with the remainder of the body by lying in the water was identified as his and taken home for burial. A cap was found which proved that a young man named Marvin was lost. He was the only son of a widow and her only support. A simple string was all that another had to prove that a body was that of a mother. It was a present from a daughter and was tied about the hair and not been burned. A key identified by a duplicate sent by his partner from Chicago was the proof that E.P. Rogers was on the train. A coat was recognized as belonging to Mr. J. Rice of Lowell. A pair of initial sleeve buttons were found, which proved that Boyd Russell of Auburn, New York, was among the lost. The body had burned. Diamond pins and badges and valuable jewelry had disappeared, but these remained. Father and friends of Miss Minnie Mixer, after a long search, had given up all hope of finding a single trace of her remains. At last, her mother came and identified a chain which had been her daughter's. The watch of Mr. G. Kepler of Ashtabula was identified. A wife did not know her husband was on the train. She missed his letters. She heard that he had gone to Dunkirk. She searched the relics and found his knife. A lady from Toronto, a Mrs. Smith, came searching for her husband from whom she had heard just as he left Buffalo for Detroit. He had $7,000 on his person. A pocket was fished up from the stream. It contained the pocketbook and the name and a bank certificate, but the money was not there. A litter was discovered among the relics. It bore no name except that of the writer. As the envelope was gone, a brother from Massachusetts came. He found no trace except the letter. He went to Chicago and sought some of the survivors and still did not satisfy himself. He returned and consulted with some people who worked for the newspaper. Only two persons were saved from the car, which he was in. They described the occupants of the car one by one. In one seat, said they, was a gentlemanly man, quiet in manner and intelligent. He was going to South America by way of California. "That's my brother," was the cheerful answer. In a low-toned voice and tender accents, we talked, and it seemed as if the brother could not rest until all was told, that there was but little to be said. An old lady was on the train who was from the East. She was described as sitting in the middle of the car, a young man with her. He was teaching school at the time in Illinois and had spent his vacation in going after her. She was 79 years of age. Her angular features and loud voice had attracted the attention of passengers. Same lady was described in some of the newspapers that covered the wreck. A description of her given by two young men on the train was recognized by their friends, and a photograph of the young man shown to them was recognized in turn. Thus, two more were identified as being on the train. A family consisting of a gentleman and his wife and two children were in the drawing room car. They were described, people who were working with the newspaper, as neither stylish nor very plain, just a comfortable, respectable, and happy family. Mr. T.C. Wright of Tennessee had noticed them. They sat together and was impressed and told what a happy family they were. They were sitting in the stateroom and enjoying one another's company. Little girl was described as having light hair and curls which hung round her face, was very pretty, but had poor teeth. This description was sent to the Inter-Ocean of Chicago. Of course, again, that was sent to that for the newspaper that they used a source. A letter was afterwards received from Mrs. H.H. Gray of Darlington, Wisconsin, inquiring about a family which was lost, annihilated. It was written. No one could find any trace of them. An answer was required. Look into the Inter-Ocean of January 16th and read my letter. The next letter received was from the administrator of the estate. Described the gentleman as a man of extensive business, very energetic and honorable, and contained the photographs of two children. Whole family were on their way from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania to Gatewood, Wisconsin. The only survivor from the drawing room car was a Mr. Ormsby from Boston, who was nearsighted and could not tell much about those in the car. Mr. Wright, who was in the smoker at the time of the fall, belonged in this car. His description had already been recognized by people who were doing some research and for the newspapers. But the photographs were shown to Mr. Ormsby, and he, after the close examination with solemnity, said, They were the children who were in my car. Another photograph of the whole family was afterwards sent to Mr. Wright of Nashville and was recognized as the likeness of the family she had noticed in that stateroom. There is an affecting story about this family. Suppose that they were in the stateroom at the time of the fall, and by some means, the wife and children were held in the wreck and could not be extricated. Father tried to save them, but the flames arose. He could escape himself and actually did get out of the car and away from the flames, but the little girl cried out, "Papa, oh, Papa, take me." And he went back, exclaiming, "I would rather perish with my family. I can't live without them," and so all perished together. There was a storm of grief. The waves were tossing high upon the sea of life, and their crests were lifted far and wide and dropping tears upon the deep. The solemn murmur was echoed all along the shore. It intruded upon the business thoughts. Its roar was heard above the noise of commerce and the city's hum. With a melancholy sound, men for once were led to give up their eager haste and ask to what all this love of gain might tend. The serious affairs of life were brought to mind. The interests of eternity were compared to those of time. All eyes were directed to this wreck of life. All hearts were moved by the suddenness of death. But this wave of sorrow did not cease. When the storm was over and men lost their wonder, the wave swept on. Long after the calamity had failed to engage the public ear and had disappeared from the public press, the wave was spreading still, and while others had forgotten the great event, it moaned along the shore. It reached the most distant homes. It swept into many sorrowing hearts. It was a wave of grief. A father had bidden his only son goodbye in a distant city of the East. He was a lovely youth. He was destined to the West. There were those who he loved in the central city. One awaited him there to whom he was betrothed. The morning news brought the sad tidings to both those cities that sent a shock to those loving hearts. Two husbands were together on the Pacific coast. Both were expecting their wives home. They, a mother and daughter, together with a son, were on that train. 8 months they had been away on an Eastern trip. They had a large circle of friends and relatives on an island on the coast of Maine. They were on their return. They bore with them many gifts from friends, 13 quilts which had been pieced among the visiting circles, and many other valuable presents. Then a happy summer to them among those friends. They had hoped to reach their home by New Year's Day, but had been delayed. Father looked into the San Francisco papers and read the tidings of the horrible event. The son who was saved also telegraphed from the scene of the disaster. These were the startling words. "Mother and sister are both dead. My ribs are broken. My head is hurt. I've been robbed and penniless among strangers." On that second night, both those men were on their way to the scene of the disaster. The Sabbath dawned. It did not seem like Sabbath. All time lost its marks. All days were alike in the sweeping grief. There was a congregation gathered on that distant island. The news reached some, the hour of service. Tidings were conveyed to the church. The shock went through the house, and the grief was such that the services were broken up. Circle of friends embraced the whole community. Those who had been visiting and had so recently left were now stricken down by the sudden death. So the wave invaded the sanctuary of God. It overwhelmed the Sabbath sacredness. That Sabbath passed, the survivors hardly realized it was a holy day. One looked out from his window and wondered if there were any ministers in town and inquired where the churches were, for he could see no spires and only a few chimneys in the tops of houses. The bells rang out, evening bells. It was Sabbath evening. Yes, New Year's Eve, but how strange. The distant friends were on their way. Many of the dead were lying there. The festivities of the day were to be turned to mourning. Father of a lovely girl arrived that Sabbath evening. He had bidden her goodbye only 2 nights before. She was a favorite child. Everything had been done to make her education complete. No expense was spared. She just finished school and was now starting out for a winter's visit. 2 days before, there had been a wedding scene. Her dearest friend was married, and she was the bridesmaid. It was a very accomplished circle and a delightful party. That daughter was dressed in white. Her dress was trimmed with forget-me-nots. Her picture was taken in that dress. Her friends remember her as the most garlanded and adorned, but it was a passing vision. The new year was to have seen her in a distant city. A delightful circle awaited her there. First circles of two cities were interchanging greetings. She was the bright messenger between the two. At either end of that treacherous track, there were garlands and greetings. The white feet passed out from one circle, but they never reached the other. Into the valley that form went down. In that ill-fated car, she perished. And how? Now the father is looking for, but can find her not. Like a vision, she has departed. The white garments and the shadowy feet belong to an angel now. They have passed out from earthly scenes into the heavenly land. In a furnace of fire, the Savior walked and took her to himself. His form was like to the Son of Man, and the smell of fire was not in her garments, but through the fire she passed into glory. And now the Father seeks her and can never find her, never, until as an angel spirit he beholds her there. Strangers meet him and tell him if it is all wrong, vain. She was in that car, the trace of her remains. His heart is crushed, but his ways are calm, self-controlled and courteous. In the midst of grief, he returns to his home without his daughter. She's flown to other circles, and he cannot find her. But his hair catches the light of her departure, which turns white from grief. In the midst of the furnace, he receives something of a transforming power, and the tinge of the better land strikes across his brow. The city of Ohio was a public school, and in charge of it was one who had endeared himself to his pupils and was well known as the superintendent. When news of the accident was first received, fears were excited that Mr. Rogers might be on the train. Dispatch was sent to Niagara Falls, where it was known he was to be. His bride was with him, for they were married on the Tuesday before, and preparations had been made for their reception at home. Tidings came back that both were on the ill-fated train. There was most intense anxiety in the place. All classes fell upon the subject, and the least scrap of information was eagerly sought. Two gentlemen at once started for the scene, and on Sabbath, a dispatch was read in church. The worst of fears were realized, and the sorrow deepened. Again, dispatches were received. Mr. and Mrs. Rogers were burned to death, and no portion of their bodies could be recovered. Special meeting of the school board was called for appropriate action, and the most affecting and depressing scenes of the great calamity came home to all. A deep gloom was cast over the whole city and mainly put an end to the festivities of the New Year's Day. For the family in a distant place in the West, it was a family of a well-known physician. A mother was there. She was the physician's wife. The husband had left his home from the distant East to visit an aged parent, and was on his return. He visited a brother-in-law on his way home. The tidings go out that he is lost, and the family is at once stricken with grief. The whole community where he dwelt was moved. The sense of personal bereavement extends through the place and reaches the surrounding towns. The deepest feeling was manifested. It seemed as if the citizens were mourners at once, all mourned as though one of their own household had fallen. Church and community, where even the country around, were affected. Afterward, gathered at the funeral with the expression of their regard and giving token of the friendship which he had acquired. Dr. Hubbard was dead. A fragment of his body was found, and his death was mourned by the vast assemblies which crowded two houses of worship in his village home. When laid away with public obsequies and by the different colors in which he belonged, two cities were represented. And so the waves swept on. It subsided from the public gaze, but its effects were felt. Widows almost crushed, wept in secret for those they loved and over their orphaned children, lifted up their hands in agony of prayer. The letters that they came to, where they got it from, only showed how wide was this silent, this unknown sorrow. The friends would write from the distant cities and say how cruel had been the blow. How sad the case, but no one could tell the silent loneliness which lingered in those homes. Bitterness was mingled with the grief, and the sweet love of woman was turned to as almost curse the company which had left those dreadful pits for the destruction of these precious lives. Even God's forgiveness was asked, and the feeling of indignation was so intense. The secret mourning which followed the terrible crash is even now the most melancholy result of all. The sad refrain must linger for many a day through all the noise of business and the sounds of mirth. The plaintive note mingles, and the sad calamity had not lost its effect. Secret sorrow was the worst of all. At first, the wave broke upon the shore and drew back a quick returning current. Friends came at once, and public sympathy was moved, but long after they'd returned and the event had sunk away from the public mind, there was a wave which swept into lonely hearts and echoed in unknown homes. Every one of those who got out of the train had a different story. These are valuable because they bring before us a picture of the scene in different features. Someone escaped from every car but one. From the second passenger coach, no one was left to tell the tale. Everyone perished in the fall or crash. From the first and third and fifth, many escaped. From the fourth, only one. From the sixth, three. And from the last, all but one. The story of Mr. Parslow, who was in the first, had been given through the public press and given here as a description of the experience common to others, he says. First intimation he had of the affair was the sound of the crash of the bridge, and he felt and realized the sensation of the downward tendency of the coach. He clutched one of the seats to steady himself. All of a sudden, in the flash of a second, the passengers were thrown to the end of the coach, which had been reached or had reached the water. The broken pieces of ice, the snow, and fragments of the car came in with a rush. He caught the stove, which had not yet been cooled from its heat, thinking to save himself thereby from drowning. In doing so, he burned his hand to a blister, while the other portion of his body was freezing in the water. He remembered the crashing of the smoker upon his car. As soon as he could collect his thoughts, he went to work to extricate himself, but how he did it was unable to state. He only knew he was out of the car and into the fragments of ice and floating pieces of the wreck. From there, he managed to reach unbroken ice, and from thence, he climbed up the height and was the first of that scarred and bruised number to reach the top. In doing this, it is to be remembered that the poor man had a piece of gilt molding, 1 inch wide, 3/4 inch thick, and 8 inches long in a portion of his body. It entered the left shoulder, back of the collarbone, and penetrated under the shoulder blade into the side. He scarcely realized his situation till he had been conveyed to the nearest place of comfort. In his car were from 40 to 45 passengers. In the smoking car, he thinks about the same number. In his opinion, there were not less than 200 passengers in all. He says when he got out of the car in the ice, the screams of the dying and crushed broke upon his ears and were the most pitiful sounds that were ever heard. He says it all occurred in such a remarkably brief space that he cannot now realize how it was that so much of human history could be crowded into a speck of time. The experience of those in the smoking car was quite remarkable. Several who escaped from this have told of the fall. They were but four killed in it. Among them was Harry Wagner, conductor of the sleeping cars, who, it is said, was driven against and even through the end of the car by the stove, which swept through the whole length with terrible force. Conductor Mr. Hen speaks of this and says that the smoke shot past him on one side and something else fell with a crash on the other side, but he escaped. Mr. J.M. Early's experience was quite remarkable. He gives expression to the feelings, which many had in almost tragic words. He says, "And that seemed to me as if we had fallen. I was thoroughly collapsed for a minute or two. Then I heard two or three crashes, cars tumbling off the bridge and striking ours. At the second crash, I threw myself on the floor and crouched down under the seats. I did not know what the next would crush us all. There were several people near me, and I told them to crunch down or crouch down. In the coming down, the feeling was a beautiful conglomeration of swimming and swinging. I didn't know whether I was on the head or heel. That describes how I felt when the car struck the solid ice. Part of my body seemed to be going in opposite directions. I did not experience a dead calm, but a feeling of intense agony. And that continued until I came to myself. It must have been half an hour, certainly, before I knew what I was doing. Then I got up and struggled around. Terrible noise made by the falling cars made me hold my breath when I thought it was about time for another to come down. story of Mr. George A. White is the most interesting of all. First, he not only describes the car Palatine, in which so many escaped, but he gives them such an account as no other one has done. His statement is given at length. And going down, there was hardly any sound. The only thing that's heard was the heavy breathing, which bespeaks a pure of fear of suddenly something terrible to come. First sound that greeted my ear was after we struck the ice. The breaking of the glass was like rifle shots, and the train coming down made a terrific roar. Our car fell as it rode moderately and straight, which saved our lives. As soon as the car touched bottom, I could see nothing. All was dark. I groped my way out through the east end of the car. Behind us was the Buffalo car, standing on end, almost perpendicular, resting against the abutment of the bridge, one end having taken our platform. I think none of the Buffalo car passengers were saved. The coach fell on end, and I never heard a second from it after the fall, and no one came out. All was death, it had my estimation. Buffalo was full of passengers. Power car was just ahead of us, and no one came out of it. I think all the passengers that held were killed. At the right of us, facing the west, was a car that lay on its side. Top of it was onto ours. Our car lay just as it was running. I went over the roof of the other car to take a look up and around. I saw a gentleman and a lady following me. Looking into the car, I saw a large number of people lying together in a mass. The car was crushed in its bottom and sides. The scene within was horrible, heartrending, indescribable. It was enough to unnerve the bravest. There were maimed and bruised men, women, and children, all held down like the cruel timbers. They were in different stages of delirium and excitement. Some were screaming, some were groaning, and others praying. There was hardly anyone within who seemed rational. I saw the encroachments the fire was making. While on the roof of that car, I took a speedy survey of the situation. I realized the terrible yawning chasm. I shall never forget the horrors of that night. The experiences of the survivors of the city of Buffalo also are given. So many perished in this car that a description of those in it may be of interest to their friends. Story of Mr. H.A. White of Wethersfield, Connecticut, published in the daily papers, is as follows. He says, first thought that came into my mind was that there was no use for me to stir or try to help myself. I waited in that position till I heard two more crashes come when all was quiet. I then tried to see if I could not raise what was on and around me, and succeeded. I opened my eyes, and the first thing I saw was the glass in the top of the door that opened into the saloon in the rear end of the car. I struck that immediately with my hand and thrust my head through it. I spoke then. Up to this time, there was not a shriek or voice heard in the car that I was in. All had been still. He then says that he heard a voice below him. Then he endeavored to help a man out of the car after he got out himself, but failed. Mrs. Bradley, who from her nurse and child was in the rear stateroom, near the section where Mr. White was sitting, speaks of the same silence. She called repeatedly, but heard no sound except that of her own voice. She looked below her for her child and nurse. All she could see was that they were underneath the wreck. She vainly tried to lift them, but their bodies seemed to sink lower and lower in the debris. Not a sound proceeded from that direction, and the only conclusion she could arrive at was that their bodies had been crushed. The personal incidents which occurred were numerous. Many of these had been brought to public attention through the press, yet there are others which had not been narrated. Everyone had his own story, but in the confusion of the scene, no one is really supposed to have a clear view of the whole event. These incidents are told by the different passengers who escaped and by the citizens who hastened to the rescue. The following are given as showing the experiences of the women who were on the train. There were many who perished, and it's affecting to read the story of their sufferings while so helpless in the wreck. But the heroism manifested by those who escaped is especially worthy of note. The Cleveland Leader contains the following. In the time of the disaster, a man rushed down to the scene ready to help. He saw a woman struggling for life and went to her assistance. He carried her by main force to the solid ice and then, urged by the cries of the mother, went back to the rescue of a sweet child of 3 or 4 years of age. The treacherous wood and splintering had caught the child in its grasp, and the fire completed the terrible work. The man was compelled to see the child enveloped in flames and to hear her cries of, "Help me, mother," ringing out in the agony of death and on the ears of the cruel night. In a moment, she was lost, swept up by the sharp tongues of fire, while her mother, in helpless agony, fell to the earth in a deadly swoon. Mr. Reed, one of the passengers, saw a woman held in the ruins and burning. She was calling out amid her groans, "Shoot me or get me out of this misery." The saddest sight she saw, or he saw, was a woman looking at her burning child. Mrs. Lou says when the crash came, she was lying down with her head near the open window. Next thing she knew was that her head was out in the open air and her body inside of the car. As soon as she got her head out, she saw the newsboy that a few minutes before supplied with reading matter. She begged of him to help her. He said, "I would be glad to, but my old mother is dependent on me for her entire support. If I'm killed, what will she do?" Mrs. Lou again entreated him to assist her. He then came so near to her as he was able to take hold of her hand by extending his arms full length. As they joined hands, the newsboy pulled, and Mrs. Lou threw herself forward, coming out of the car. She then walked on the ice to the bank, where she was helped up the embankment by men and taken to an eating house where her wounds were dressed. A villager saw a woman caught back of the platform railing and attempted to pull her out. So only by a superhuman effort he succeeded, then only to find them both up to the waist in the water. "Can you save me?" she asked him, and told it went to his heart. "Yes, if you hold on," he said. She did hold on to him with all her strength, and he got her safely to the shore, although in the water several times. The story of Mrs. Bingham had been already told. She owed her life to her own determined spirit, though it is remarkable that anyone with a broken limb could summon the courage to break a window and then jump into the water and draw herself to the land. The heroism of Mrs. Swift had been mentioned in the papers, and people, you know, that were reporting this besides, like, newspaper men or detectives or whoever they had, you know, working around there to add to the testimony, to the noble and lovely spirit which she manifested through all the sad scenes, following the account of the manner of her escape. Mrs. Swift retained her senses and her presence of mind. She was badly injured at the time but did not realize it. When the accident occurred, there was a terrible crash. The bell rope snapped like the report of a pistol, and the lights were extinguished. As the cars went down, there was no noise. Her husband was hurled across the aisle and held down senseless. She was wedged in between two seats but extricated herself. She spoke to her husband, but made no reply. She thought he was dead. The agony of her mind at that moment was fearful to contemplate. She finally, with the aid of Mr. White, got him out. He was then delirious and hardly knew where he was going. Her anxiety was all for her husband. Ms. Shepherd, Mrs. Graham, and Mr. White then took on assisted everybody out of the car, reassuring them by words and deeds that it thus aided in saving many lives. Ms. Shepherd of Ripon, Wisconsin, proves to have been a heroine in a terrible tragedy. Many of the survivors have spoken of her as so brave in the midst of the danger. She was very cool and collected, says Mr. Sturgis, and she acted in a heroic manner. She helped the women out, and while I was trying to get the men out, she was on the outside, smashing the windows with a piece of timber, clearing the way for those inside. Mr. White of Portland says she was one of the bravest and best women I ever met. She got out by herself when I at last came out of the Palatine. After I was satisfied that there were no more persons in the car, the gentlemen who had their legs broken were still lying within a few feet of the burning cars, and their lives were now again in jeopardy. To save their lives was my next endeavor. I couldn't take the two at once, so I took hold of one and dragged him some 30 feet away. Poor fellow, I had several ribs broken, he had several ribs broken, and his ankle was swollen to three times its size. I was very weary at this time. The fire was all the time encroaching more and more, and the agonizing cries of suffering and burning humanity were hushed as they suffocated, or the cruel flames sent death to relieve them. I got my man away, but the other was still there. This one was delirious from pain and excitement. I was anxious for both. Citizen from Ashtabula came along, and I asked him to watch my charge while I brought back the other to a place of safety. He said he would. I had just reached the other van when I turned around and saw the citizen had deserted his post. But there stood Miss Shepherd by me. We stood in full 18 inches of snow and 6 inches of water, the ice having been broken and crushed by the cars. She said coolly, "Can I do something to help you? I am uninjured." I got the other man away to a place of safety, some 12 feet back from the car. It wasn't over 7 minutes after the fall before our car was burning, too. Mr. C.E. Torres says he saw her standing on the ice and dipping her handkerchief in the water and washing away the blood from the face of a wounded man. And the citizens of Vestibule also speak of her and say that it seems so strange to see her while all the rest were wounded and bleeding, moving around the engine room, assisting in every way, calm and self-possessed. She seemed more like some good angel who had been sent at such an hour to bestow the gentle ministration of her sex upon the suffering. The citizens of Ashtabula did all in their power. The disaster was no sooner known than many of them hastened to the rescue. Great exertions were made by those who were present, not only to save the living, but as far as possible in their separate action to extinguish the flames. The survivors were no sooner in a condition to be removed than persons were found who were ready to take the worst cases among them to their own homes. Some of the wounded who were left near the depot, especially those who were at the Eagle Hotel, were removed to the hotels uptown and comfortably provided for. Ladies called upon them wherever they were and carried to them such delicacies as would tempt their appetites and flowers to please the eye and vied with each other in giving attention to the strangers, all of them showing how much their sympathies had been moved by this sad calamity. The mayor of the city was very energetic, and amid the excitement of the first few days, he not only met the responsibilities of his office with promptness, but he showed the kindness of his heart in that he took one of the wounded, a Mr. Tomlinson, to his house and then cared for him until he died. Mr. Strong, the station agent, also, though laboring under the oppressive sense of being misunderstood, did all that he could under the circumstances. Several of the firemen have borne testimony to the great exertions which he made during the night of the fire. The disadvantage under which he labored on that night was that he was not present at the depot at the time of the accident, but was at home about half a mile away. The orders from the central office in reference to surgeons reached him through the telegraph office uptown, and his first duty was to obey them. But as he reached the scene of the fire, the very sympathy which he felt led him under the excitement of the moment to give those answers which did so much damage and which were so much misunderstood. The railroad authorities continued to furnish everything that might relieve the sufferings or restore the losses of those who survived. Physicians were procured and nurses provided. Every accommodation which hotels could furnish was paid for with a liberal hand. Those whose clothing had been destroyed or injured were furnished with new suits throughout. The bills of physicians were paid, return tickets were furnished, and sleeping car accommodations afforded to the wounded to their very homes. As friends came in search of the lost, they at times received free passes each way, and even escorts in some cases were furnished. Bereaved mothers and fathers and the widowed were permitted to visit the place in search of relics at the company's expense. The event was a calamity to the road as well as to the passengers and their friends. The managers had prided themselves on the success and completeness of their system. The small number of accidents on the line had been noticed, but the sudden and terrible calamity eclipsed all this, and now the grief was great and widespread. The horror was overwhelming, and the excitement high. It was impossible to know this without feeling it as a personal affliction, and no doubt the sense of it led to the death of the man who, of all others, was the most sensitive and sympathetic. The attention of religious people to the spiritual wants of the survivors is worthy of mention. Clergymen called and conversed with them, and opportunity was offered. The survivors were hardly able at first to give expression to their feelings as the confusion of the place was so great. Several were crowded into the same room. The wounds inflicted on the head prevented connected thoughts. The pains and weakness and the shock to the nervous system rendered the condition of nearly everyone critical for several days. It seemed uncertain whether they might not sink away under the terrible reaction and depression caused by the excitement and exposure. Wounds and bruises, which no one supposed they had, were felt and new ones discovered every day. But as one and another were removed to separate rooms, the conversations and prayers brought out the deeper feelings which had been hidden. It was with great solemnity that one and another would recount the peculiar method of escape. More than one said that he thought his time had come. One said that he did not expect to live and that he took his card in his hand that his name might be recognized if he should die. The suddenness of death was full of solemnity to all. Even the most reckless and hardened were subdued. One young man, in a spirit of bravado, as he entered the room of a companion, uttered an oath that the gentleman addressed rose in bed, lame and wounded as he was. It was Saul, a voice and determined manner, exclaimed, "I will not permit the name of God to be used in that way in my presence, especially at such a time as this." The young man felt the rebuke and turned around, hid his face, and soon retired. A few days after, he came back and said that he had not arisen from his bed of mourning without thanking God for preserving his life and apologized for having spoken as he did. A gentleman and his wife who had escaped from the Palatine were together at the American House, happy in being there to each other, peaceful, loving, and grateful. But they were especially delighted to receive a letter from their pastor in the distant East and read to those who called sentences from it, so glowing with pastor's affection and sympathy. The ministration of women was one of the delightful things connected with the event. A betrothed had no sooner heard of the wreck and of the survival of her lover than she hastened to his side and spent the days in caring for him and comforting him by her presence. When the clergyman visited those different persons at their hotels, they were most respectful in their cordial response to prayer and words of counsel. Even those to whom the subject had not altogether been agreeable before listened and seemed stirred to the heart with grateful emotions. Time and place for prayer was given, and such dearness to the Almighty God was never known before. It seemed as if the veil of eternity had opened and the presence of God was felt. A loving wife, so gentle and so good, had come to her husband's side. The affection and the care were great, but the gratitude to God was more, and the piety of both became suddenly deep. It was like the stream in the prophet's vision as the past of Christian life was reviewed so seriously. Penitence sprang up within the heart, and then the gratitude to God, and then the consecration, and then the delightful swelling love and peace, and then the faith that seemed to hide itself in God's own heart, and there was a mingling of the emotions, as if the ocean of God's presence was receiving them to his own deep love, and they were taking the first baptism of the Spirit. The goodness of that precious wife now had its triumph. It brought the husband's heart and soul to the same deep faith and piety which she had possessed. A gentleman, too, who had never made a profession of religion, but whose conversation showed much of acquaintance with the world and habits of observation, was led to unburden his heart's inmost thoughts to the clergyman who called in. He said, "I am not a professor of religion, sir. I am a worldly man, a man of business, but I have been brought up religiously. I've had a praying father and mother, and it seems to me as if I had some faith for as I was going down to that wreck and felt that indescribable sensation of falling." And here he dropped his hands beside the bed with such expressive look and gesture. A passage of scripture flashed into my mind and has been running in it ever since. These are the words, "The foundation of the Lord stands sure." The clergyman turned to the Bible and found the text and was impressed with the wonderful appropriateness of it. "Foundation of the Lord standeth sure, and the Lord knoweth them that are his." The time at length arrived for laying away the unburied dead. Nobody had recognized them. God alone knew them, and therefore, to his sacred earth were they consigned, that at the resurrection day he might bring them forth to the knowledge of all. Garnered in the harvest of flame, they were to be laid away in God's storehouse. The hands of strangers were outstretched to bury them, for the hearts of others could only mourn for them without claiming the poor remnants which were so unrecognizable. Their sepulcher was in the stranger soil, though their memory was in many a home. The village of Ashtabula, made memorable by so direful a calamity, was now to become the sacred burial place of those bodies which perished. Most sacredly did the citizens of the place regard this trust which God in his providence had committed to them. No event in the history of the place had so awakened sympathy and aroused the people, and now every attention that was possible was to be paid at the last sad funeral rites. The town gave itself up to mourning. Arrangements had been previously made for the occasion, and the authorities of the city, the social organizations, and the religious bodies were all prepared to honor those who were to be laid away in their midst. A beautiful lot had been chosen in the cemetery which overlooked the whole city, and there, among the sacred remains of their own beloved, the citizens resolved to place those who were indeed strangers to them, but whom somebody loved. Among the choicest lots of that beautiful hill, a place had been chosen for their deposit. The winding sheet of snow had been dried aside, and the graves had been dug and multitudes assembled for the vicinity. And the result was that an immense assemblage was gathered for the solemn services. A special train arrived from Cleveland bringing the officers of the railroad and the friends and parishioners of Reverend Dr. Washburn and others. By noon, all the places of business were closed and the citizens gathered at the services or arranged themselves in the long procession. The first church service was held in the Methodist house, as it was the largest in the place, and as this, the clergyman of the village took part. The opening prayer was made by Reverend I.O. Fisher of the Baptist Church, with a few touching words in memory of P.P. Bliss. Reverend McLeary of the Methodist Church read the hymn, "We're Going Home Tomorrow." The appropriate selection of scripture was read by Reverend Mr. Safford of the Congregational Church, after which Reverend J.C. White of the St. John Episcopal Church of Cleveland delivered an eloquent discourse on the subject of the sacredness of human life. He was followed by Reverend S.D. Peach, who spoke of the need of a sympathy which should be unselfish and universal, and of the need of preparation for death. Reverend Mr. McGifford of the Presbyterian Church also made remarks upon God's knowledge and of the unrecognized dead. The choir sang another of the songs of P.P. Bliss, "There is a Light in the Valley." The services were impressive, and the great congregation which had assembled seemed moved by deep sympathy. The closing remarks of Mr. White were especially appropriate, being a beautiful illustration showing that life itself was but a great bridge, one end of which lay in life's beginning, and the other stretched into the great unknown. Spans a chasm full of fire, of death and doom. There were flaws in it which were put there 6,000 years ago, and although many have gone over it safely, it is at any moment liable to fall with some precious soul into the abyss. God had provided a means of escape, and happy was he who would avail himself of it. A second service was also held at St. Peter's Church, at which Reverend Dr. James Moore officiated, assisted by Reverend George Carter of Cleveland. Procession then followed, which was arranged in the following order: Marshal Fassett and Coroner Richards, clergy in sleighs, bearers in sleighs, assistant marshal, Masonic Association, friends of deceased in sleighs, assistant marshal, St. Joseph Society, Ashtabula Light Guard, Ashtabula Light Artillery, citizens generally. Arranged in a long line in front of the churches and along the main street with the different badges and the insignia of office, this procession formed one of the most impressive pageants ever witnessed in the place. It was more than a mile long, and it moved at the toll of the bell, and with the impressive sound of the funeral dirge. From the bands present, everyone was affected with the solemnity of the occasion. Our contrast is with the white snow, which covered the landscape, this array of mourning and sympathizing friends and citizens move slowly to the last resting place of the dead. As the head of the column entered the cemetery where were gathered the sacred remains which were to be deposited in the graves, the members of the Masonic societies divided and, acting as pallbearers, silently took up the coffins which had been arranged in a line for them and bore the precious freight to the open graves amid the tears of the spectators who were touched by so unusual a sight. It was indeed a scene which appealed to the heart with somber power and deep sympathy. The 19 coffins containing the secrets of death, which will be given up only at the resurrection, carried between the slow-moving ranks of uncovered men, the sad flares or fares and intent gaze of the silent witnesses, a few mourning women in black standing apart, made sacred by their sorrow, one gray-haired man whose wife and child had been swallowed up in the gulf, among them a dull gray sky overhead, the fitful wind sweeping through the bare branches of the trees, the shroud of snow broken only by those yawning graves, the sad strains of the funeral dirge in time with the sobbing of the women, the solemn hush which men feel always in the presence of death. The exercises at the grave were opened by the Reverend Mr. Moore, who read the burial service of his church. Selection of scripture was read by the Reverend Mr. McGifford, after which the Masons proceeded with their ritual, and at its close, the assembled thousands dismissed with a benediction proceeded to their homes or to the evening trains, which were to convey them out of the city. There was a young lady on that train. Accomplished and beautiful, she had already become the object of admiration to many and was the pride of fond parents. Blooming, buoyant, and hopeful, she was a delightful companion. Her light, rosy complexion, so radiant, made her a picture of health. She used to laugh and say to her mother, "I never have any compliments except that I am such a healthy-looking girl." Her mother writes, "On her sweet, fair hand, she wore a slender thread of gold, which held the setting of a very brilliant, though not large, diamond. On the same finger, she wore a heavy, plain gold ring. Her wardrobe was very complete and almost entirely new. Her jewelry consisted of turquoise, pearls, Florentine mosaics, and Genoese silver. Everything she had in the way of ornament or jewelry she had with her. She had a link gold necklace and gold handkerchief ring with a small ring for the finger attached by a slender chain. A Shigeri medal in the form of a Greek enamel cross was in her trunk, the sign of honor from the school where she had graduated. In that trunk were also many dresses, beautiful and expensive and becoming to her form. All she had, she took with her. Her bridesmaid's dress was with her. She was dressed in it only the week before at the wedding of her dearest friend. She also had it on at the wedding the night before she started. Yet she was not a mere child of fashion. She was born to social position and always accustomed to society. It was the daily habit of her life, but brought no excitement with it. She really cared but little for parties and often spoke in that way. She was an active member of the Episcopal Church and very conscientious in the performance of her duties. Her love of sacred music seemed like an inspiration. I watched her face become almost transfigured by a holiness of expression which would flit across it while she was singing. She'd been kept singularly free from the little vanities and excitements of a young lady's life by the grace of God, who kept her as pure a child as when he gave her to me, a precious infant. Oh, it comes to me now how carelessly I thought of my treasure, how little I appreciated the great trust that God had given me, how I thought of her as an ordinary girl. The thought of her death had never entered the minds of her parents, but she died, and everything connected with her was strangely swept away. The sad consolation of weeping over her silent remains was denied. Her picture, for which she stood 2 days before her starting, was the only mercy which God had vouchsafed the parents. Her mother again writes, "It would indeed be a comfort to me to have even one little thing which would seem a part of herself, but we have not one trace of her personal belongings. Her funeral was attended in the city of her home, but the remembrance of her sweet spirit and beautiful voice with all that the friends had to comfort them. Following are the eloquent, heartfelt words which dropped from the lips of an affectionate, aged pastor at her funeral. As the sweet fragrance of her life and spirit came before his mind, he says, "I dearly, hardly venture a few words upon the sweet singer of our Israel, who was but yesterday the charm and the graceful and eloquent ornament to our choir. Here she won the confidence and love of all of us. Here she uttered those sweet sounds which captivated all hearts. Here she became known to us as the happy, the cheerful, the glad, and always unselfish and noble-natured girl, the almost idol of her bereaved parents and the pride and joy of her companions. Here on the last day of our Holy Communion service, she was present and joined with us in that hallowed song of love and worship which she now repeats and sings with the angels and blessed spirits of that other and better world in the presence of God and his holy angels. Thus passed away the beautiful, the lovely, the song-like spirit of sweet Minnie Mixer. Story has been told of a young man who was so anxiously looked for some trace of his mother's body during those sad days in which so much sorrow was concentrated. Description of that mother's character has been well drawn by those who knew her. Mrs. Adelia A. Moore of Hammondsport was a member of the Episcopal Church, and the following are the tributes of affection bestowed by the clergyman who officiated at her funeral. Reverend Mr. Cushing said of her, "Can I ever forget her presence and her image under my own roof during the three of the most painfully anxious days of my life, watching through the long, long winter night, wakeful to every sound, to every movement, to every want, the low, soothing voice, the noiseless step, the gentle hand wiping away the clammy sweat, and standing by us patiently and willingly till the crisis was past. Mrs. C., dangerously ill of pneumonia, is the occasion referred to." I could not but refer to this not only as an expression of grateful acknowledgement, which is justly done, but also as speaking for many others to whom she was a friend indeed, because a friend in need, just that kind of need in which, above all other needs, we feel the weakest, the most utterly powerless in our own unaided selves. In this way, and in these kind offices, she may be said, wherever residing and through all the mature years of her life, to have gone about doing good, unsuspicious, unpublished good, and the crowning beauty of it all as respects her is that she claimed no merit for these disinterested acts, expecting no human recompense, but performed them when at anyone's call, because she deemed it her duty to go because it was the impulse of her sympathetic heart. She was truly the good Samaritan of her sex. The Reverend Mr. Gardner also said, and oh, how much we shall all miss her. We shall miss her as a busy pariah worker or parish worker. We shall miss her in the Sunday school, and her class of little children will sadly miss her. So will the Ladies' Sewing Society miss her, for she was one of its chief workers, but memorials of her in the society's work will long remain, even longer, perhaps, than any of us shall live to see. And the sick and afflicted will most surely miss her, for it may be said of her, as it was of her divine master, she went about doing good. For this work she had a peculiar fitness, going in and out among the sick as if it were her special calling. Many of the families where she had ministered, and with one voice they would attest all that I have said of her. But above all, her family will miss her, and the wife and mother, sister and their relative are gone, God before, but not lost. And the Reverend Mr. Hurd said of her, of the estimable lady whose death was commemorated, it may be said that one had been taken out from the bosom of this church and of this community who was inspired and warmed with all its life, religious, social, and domestic, alive to and promoting according to her ability everything which conduced to its welfare and improvement. All this consolation which may ever be legitimately drawn from Christian character may be justified, claimed, and unappropriated here. She was indeed a good woman and one of the saints of God.
It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio,
rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn. The question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time. Find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30, 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 13th, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
All right. And Ruth, who do we got with us yet?
Well, we always have the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. Just pretty crowded in here. Just can't see them. We have you, Brother, Sister Emily, her dad, Jim, and six with me.
All right. So, we'll let first, Emily, what did you think?
That was really something.
A lot of information about the survivors and those that lost loved ones. A lot of information there.
Yeah. Did I hear Bruce say that Six was on tonight?
Yeah, he's on tonight. We're going to give him a chance here in a sec if you've got any other comments or questions.
No, the only other thing I was going to do is ask the listeners to keep me in prayer because I'm not doing real good.
All right. Well, Six, your turn. Any questions or comments? Once, of course, you got your coffee.
Where is beverage of choice?
All right. Think he may be away from his phone or he forgot to unmute himself.
Honey, could I say something for a minute?
Go ahead, Ruth.
Okay, I was actually down there for a college course. I had to pick up rocks. Okay. I didn't find any relics, but there's been a lot of people who still are hanging around there looking for relics. I doubt if there's any relics there now. But you know what? I actually saw trilobites on the rocks. They're little tiny little trilobites, little critters. And then I just had a little fun looking around. I felt so terrible. Now that I've studied about it, it's just such a scary thing that happened to these poor souls, you know. And I wish they would have put water on them so they didn't cremate them.
Well, when you were looking for rocks, Ruth, did any come from your head?
Very funny. But I did get a good grade for picking up the rocks. Mr. Callahan's geology course at Kent State, I should be well. It just was a, you know, kind of a nice, I had fun down there. I liked being down there.
You sure the rocks came from the Gulf, or did it come from your head?
It didn't come from my head, but
Kenny,
it sure did come from L&GY.
Kenny, I think you're
going to
get yourself in trouble over there.
But I still love him, and I am glad Emily's on tonight, but I wish she was better. So I'm going to definitely pray for her a long time tonight.
So what kind of rocks you got in your head, obsidian or igneous?
Well, these were igneous that I had to pick up.
Oh.
But we also had a lot of lineup stuff we had to pick up, and I got this big box, and Grandpa went down there with me, and we had a blast.
So. All right, so Six, are you still there? Did you unmute yourself? All right. Well, it looks like he had something else he went to do. So what we're going to do, we're going to get ready to close out tonight. Just want to remind those out there, if you wish to keep shows just like this one on the air, you've got two options of giving us a donation. First off, for you PayPal users, you could go to paypal.com, and the email address you enter is 6i6@gmail.com. Again, S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, digit number 6@gmail.com, S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, digit number 6@gmail.com. For you Cash App users, you'll enter $ S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, digit 2, digit 4, again, $S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, digit 2, digit 4, and in both cases, you enter the dollar amount of your love gift, and no matter how big or small, is greatly appreciated, and we here at the Six Eyes Radio Network thank you very, very much, and yes, God will bless you for your love gift. And then also, if you wish to get this show and last week's show and then next week's show on your phone, smartphone, tablet, whatever, just go in to where you have your podcast, where it says podcast. Enter in the search box Six Eyes Radio, S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, space R-A-D-I-O, Six Eyes Radio. And then you hit your search, and when it pops up there, you'll see it, most likely with starting Motivational Monday, but you'll see Six Eyes Radio. And when you do see it, click subscribe. Click subscribe, and you will have Six Eyes Radio 7 days a week, and you can listen to Jumbo Braille program normally that comes on Thursday. You can listen to that on Sunday if you like. Or listen to the Sunday Gospel show on a Saturday. So, yes, you get Six Eyes Radio Network when you want it, how you want it, at whatever time you want it. So even though, let's say, the Gospel show is at 1 p.m., you could listen to it at 3 a.m. That's the beauty of it. So you want to do that. And so for Brother Six Eyes, and all the team here at the Six Eyes Radio Network, we want to say God bless, good night, and we'll catch you tomorrow for the Talk with Missionary Ken and Ruth Wolfgang show at 9 p.m. So God bless. Catch you tomorrow.
God bless everyone.